This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Welcome to episode 29 of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the podcast that is actually just one big social game. My name is Matt Wolf, and I'm your host. Our topic for this episode is designing large group games. And with me this time are two designers who have experience designing these types of games. The first one is Graham Russell. Hey, Graham.
Hey, Matt.
And also with us is Drew Hicks. Hey, Drew.
Hey, everyone.
All right, and let's go right into our first segment here, which is our What's in the Oven segment. So, Drew, what you been working on lately?
So, UmPub 7's coming up. I've been working on a couple of games that I'm going to be bringing to that. The first one is Access, which does not really fit our topic here today, which is kind of a big cyberpunk network-building kind of game. The other two, so I'm only bringing one of them officially to UmPub, but the other two are games that are intended to have a much larger audience, and hopefully talking about some stuff today will help me out as well as help out some of the listeners. So those games are Tall Order, which is kind of a dexterity. So I'm about to lie. It's a dexterity trick-taking game. It's not a trick-taking game. That's a lie. But it's a dexterity trick-taking game because you play cards that follow a suit on the card that the first person played. And the value of it determines what you, whether or not you have to do something. But it's not a trick-taking game, but it's a trick-taking game, though. And then Jinx is a big cooperative party game, which is one of the games that, while I've been designing it, has had the most... I've learned the most about how to design games to work with big groups of people. And so hopefully be able to share some of that today. So,
all right. And yeah, we'll definitely have to try to get some large groups of designers together to play those maybe after hours at an UmPub. That's usually pretty fun to do. How about you, Graham? What you been working on?
So I was spending a lot of time working on a game I've mentioned a couple times in here before, Pixel Factory, which is a co-design with me and Daniel Solis. We got a lot of good publisher feedback and have been working for the last month or two on getting that ready, and that'll show up at UmPub this year too. The other thing I've just started working on is a large group social game called The Savant. Very, very early stages, but I keep finding myself in the realm of these large group games, and I'm here once again.
You just get gravitated to them for some reason.
Yeah, you know, they're difficult to design sometimes, but I'm having fun with it.
All right, very good. So let's kind of ease our way into our main topic here, which is designing large group games. First, let's just mention real quick some of the stuff that we've worked on. So, Graham, you already mentioned The Savant. What other large group games have you worked on?
Yeah, so that's my third game in this kind of genre. The first game I ever made and my first published game is a game called The Fittest, which is based on, you know, reality competition shows. And that is a 4-6 player game that's very, very based on negotiation and trust and lack of it. The other game I've made, and it's in the process of figuring out where it goes, is a 4-8 player game called Party Politics, which is a game in which you're in two parties, but you're not competing as teams. So it has an interesting dynamic of just kind of who to trust and how much. But yeah, those are mostly the kinds of things I work on.
All right. And Drew, other than Jinx and Tall Order, have you worked on anything else that you'd call a large group game?
I haven't worked on anything else that I would call a large group game. So I think those are the ones that I think are expected to go. For me, that would mean like more than six people are playing it. I think six is the upper end of a typical game group sized game for me. So things that go beyond that are, I guess, what I would call large group. So those are the two that I've worked on that fit that.
Yeah. And Matt, you've been designing a game that's absolutely in this realm.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before, but Split the Loot is right now a 4-8 player game all about after your long successful career of thieving. Now you and your fellow thieves need to figure out who's going to get what from your loot pile, and one of the players is also an undercover cop that no one knows who it is, and they're trying to finger the other thieves and try to get them to bribe them at the end of the game. And yeah, so there's a lot of negotiation, a lot of I shouldn't say a lot, but there's a deduction in it as well. That one has, it's actually been like 18 months since I started that, which for me is weird that I'm still working on something that long. Usually I either abandon it or it's in some other state by this point. But yeah, this one has been very different from anything else that I've worked on previously, and it's been really interesting. I also have another one that I don't even have a name for it yet. We tried it a couple meetings ago. I don't think either of you were in that test. It's also another sort of simultaneous choice game where you're either going to choose to take money or you're going to choose to hopefully draft treasure cards. I'll have to show that to you guys sometime. But yeah. That one is literally like, let's see if this is a thing, you know, level. And it sort of is, but I gotta, you know, focus on other things for Unpub 7.
Yeah, you know, designing a game like this can take a long time, as we'll probably get into.
So Drew hinted at what he considers to be a large group game. So you're saying six plus sure. players. Is there any other criteria that you would have for a large group game, or is that pretty much as long as it does six or more players?
So just to, I don't know, head off at the pass, kind of like a comment section pedant that might run in here and shout stuff at me. Maybe they also have to care about what each other are doing. So Bingo is not a large group game despite having hundreds of players, because they don't ever need to look at each other. They could just, there's no way of, the experience isn't different if they're playing in a room of just them versus a room of all of those other people. They're just looking at their board and don't need to consider what anyone else has done.
Right. And we can talk about how Bingo isn't a game because you don't make any decisions in it at all.
All right, sure.
But yeah, the idea of multiplayer solitaire isn't really what we're going to talk about today.
All right, so how about something like Quix, where, you know, like especially the deluxe edition that goes up to eight players that GameRight put out, is that the kind of game that we're talking about? Like you do have to pay a little bit of attention to other players, but not necessarily. You could just, you know, look at your own board and not pay attention to anyone else. Would that fit your definition of what a large group game kind of is, or is that one just, it just happens to play a lot of players?
Yeah, for me, it wouldn't fit the kind of game that I have in my mind when we're talking about this, because like, so it is useful for some of the same purposes. So I'm like, if I'm organizing a game group, having a game like that is a game that can play if I have eight or nine, well, not that one nine, but if I have some number of people, that's more than what I would typically expect. So it feels like the same like social niche, I guess. But those games are all designed kind of like a server client kind of deal, right? Like there's a central set of information, and every player looks at that central set of information and makes some decision based off of it. So I don't know. Like I don't think that those types of games are going to run into the same types of issues that we're going to talk about. I don't think you're going to have as much trouble playtesting a game like that as you might have with a game where a large group of people have to interact with each other and have to see the information that each other have access to. I don't know. So I don't think I would classify that. And even if we did, I don't think there's a whole lot of interesting, I don't think there's a lot of interesting hurdles to talk about with a game that's designed in that sort of way that make it different than a game that's like a smaller game that has the same kind of setup.
Gotcha. Okay. How about you, Graham? Do you agree with that?
Yeah. So I think there's some things that we'll talk about that might be helpful if that's the sort of game you want to work on. There are challenges just with having that player count that we'll talk about. But generally what we're going to talk about is if a game can't be played with six, it's probably not what we're talking about. And if it can be played with two, it's not what we're talking about. Even if it's like 2 to 20, if you can play that game with two and it's not some special weird variant that simulates four or five other people, then yeah, no, that's just a game that happens to scale more than like a game designed for a social experience.
Sure.
Okay. So like something like Codenames, where the two and three player, like effectively they're, variants off of the main rule, rule set.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And so yeah, it's similar but different than what I think everyone would agree with the core game is, which is the 4+ player and almost the more the better in that game. Okay. So what are there any other characteristics of the kind of games that we're talking about that we haven't mentioned yet? Anything else you want to add, Graham or Drew?
No, I think we're good.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I'm all right.
All right. So let's kind of dive into the challenges of kind of designing one of these games. So Graham, you have the most experience out of all of us. Why don't you start in on this one?
Yeah. So there are a few different aspects of designing something like this that make it very difficult, but they boil down to two kind of very specific things. One is you have to communicate things to all these people simultaneously, and whether you're playtesting it or you're getting to the end product, you need a game that appeals to a wider audience, so that if you have a large group, the people in the group will all play the same game. You can have 2-4 player games that, only attract certain types of people, like people who really get into worker placement or whatever, but you can't have a game that limits its audience more than it needs to for that sort of player count.
So when you're saying a wider audience, are you talking mechanically, or are you talking thematically, or both, or something else?
I think both. It helps, but mainly what I'm talking about is accessibility. That it can't be an intimidating thing. One, because whoever's doing this, whether it's you while you're designing or whoever's playing at the end, is going to have to communicate this to 7 people simultaneously. But also, the 7 people are going to have to keep wanting to play, that it's not going to be too confusing. But just from my experience, especially like teaching things to people, there are 2 challenges. One, really, when you're talking to 2 or 3 people that are around you, there's a lot more room for you to stumble a little bit, for you to not totally have the rules down, for you to remember a thing. If that happens, if there are any stumbles at all, if you are trying to talk to 7 or 8 people at the same time, then that really becomes a problem. The other part of that is, if you're trying to play test a game, if you can get the 6 people together for your game, great. You shouldn't have to get 9 or 10 or 12 people together to get 6 people willing to play the game. So it's important for something like that to make it so not just it's simple for you to tell them, but it's also simple for them to get, that I think is really important.
Hmm. So I haven't played it because I don't want to devote an entire day of my life to it. But what about something like Mega Civilization, which is a 5-18 person game that takes literally 8 hours to play and is not a simple game? That is a pretty deep, and I believe fairly rules intensive game.
Yeah.
I mean, is that just an exception to the rule, or is that doing something, or is that just found a niche that people have responded to for some reason?
You start to get into a different sort of category of game there. You're getting into sort of mega game category of there's this big thing that requires a lot of setup and planning and sort of event management to do. But even with a lot of that stuff, you talk about, mega games that have gotten big, not necessarily, Mega Civ, but any of these big event stuff, they're big and complicated for someone to run. But each individual person's thing they're doing, if is communicated to them specifically, they have a relatively simple set of things that they can do. It can be a complicated game in aggregate, but you need to be able to explain to a person what they're doing very quickly.
Okay. Yeah, I also haven't played. What's the real popular one? Watch the Skies? Is that the one?
Yeah.
Yeah. I also
unfortunately, we don't live, in London or Seattle or wherever they've had those games. I'd love to run one, but I've seen them played, and it's very clear. all those people, what it's doing is taking a complicated game and breaking it down so that really is your role is go here and say yes or no to things or move these things on this map. That is you, you know. So it's a complicated game, but what am I doing? Go there and do that, and then you're on your way.
It's kind of like exponentially bigger Space Cadets kind of thing. Each person has their own little system that interfaces with everyone else's systems. Maybe they don't actually entirely understand how their thing interfaces with everyone else's stuff.
Right.
Maybe that's okay.
Or even to talk about a slightly newer game, we could talk about Captain Sonar. That game kind of gets complicated. But it's like, what do? You listen to the other team and then tell us when there's stuff we need to know. You know, like, done. Great. That's my job. You know, it's complex, but it's not complicated.
Okay. Yeah. So the individual's responsibilities within the greater system are simple, and they understand what they're doing, but not necessarily the entire system, or at least not on like initially.
I don't think it's a requirement. You can definitely have a game where everyone's doing the same thing, and that's mostly where I've tried to stick, because designing 14 games that interact with each other is way harder than designing one game. The important thing is just to make sure that the barrier of entry to the player is as low as you can get it.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, so I think probably what the types of games that are more touchstones for what we're talking about are things like The Resistance, Two Rooms and a Boom, maybe even something like Dixit. One of the versions of Dixit does up to 12 players.
Right.
Games that kind of those natures that are pretty easy to explain and to get into, and have a lot of interaction between the players in some manner, which might be it could be like a negotiation type manner, or it could be in a deduction type manner, or it could just be in like, I'm trying to get into the head of someone else, that type of manner. But I think, those are kind of the games that we have in mind.
Cash and guns. Like that sort of stuff. You can get into the sort of social aspect, but yeah.
Bang's an interesting example. So Bang's a bit different from the other ones we talked about. And then another one that I thought I would want to throw in there, just cause it's, to me, most of the other ones we talked about had some aspect of deduction or identity, kind of figuring out some secret information from the group. Mm-hmm. What about something like Time's Up?
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, any sort of party game fits in here. If it's a modern, if it's a well-designed party game, then I think it's absolutely part of this discussion.
The reason I wanted to bring up that one specifically is because it does really matter. It's like a lot of party games, you have a bigger group, they just kind of fudge it, right? And they're like, oh, you're in teams now, and play it some kind of a way, now you're in teams, right? But in that specific game, you do still really have to pay attention to what each other group of players is doing. I mean, sometimes it doesn't fudge it that way. It makes it in such a way that you have to still be paying attention to what each other pair of people is doing in the game, and you can't just you don't become an aggregate player with like four other people the way that sometimes happens in some like older party games. Most of the new ones avoid that, but
and if somebody's played Monikers, that game is identical, so
roughly identical.
Which, to be fair, I mean, they all are derived from Telephone, you know, so it's not like Time's Up invented that style of game or anything like that. Or not a Telephone, Celebrity.
Celebrities,
It's an audio medium, so no one can see the face that was being made there. The Telephone.
Don't worry, we'll get that in editing.
Gonna put it in post.
That's right. Yeah. The image for this episode will be Drew's face right there. What are you talking about, you crazy person? Monikers is just like, I guess, a little bit more modern content in the game, but it's pretty much exact gameplay as far as I'm aware.
It's a very accessible, very carefully designed version of that thing that's been around forever in a way that I like a lot. Because I've played a lot of those games, and there is a barrier to entry to Celebrities variant games, and that is that you have to know people. Whereas Monikers puts in a lot of like, this is a hipster. Like, okay, great. Yeah, you don't need to know anyone in particular. You don't need to know who the Secretary General of the UN is right now. You know, it's just like, here's some stuff you can get. You're not going to be totally bad at this.
Which they also put some like descriptive text on all of the cards just in case you're totally. So like Time's Up tries to resolve that by letting you hate draft out a couple of cards if you just have no idea what they are. But still, the first round you can get hung up on. Here's this political figure. I have no idea who this person is. I'm going to try to phonetically create their name or something like that, which is sometimes funny to watch, but also sometimes really painful.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. This is an aside, but it is somewhat hilarious to watch someone trying to deal with a card that they have no idea what it is. And trying to like break it down, like phonetically or a homonym or something like that. And, you know, it just is like the fourth time it goes around the table. Finally, someone's like, oh yeah, I finally remember from the other, 12 times that people were trying to, tell exactly what this thing was. I'm finally getting it in that manner, which is kind of funny. But it's probably not the best gameplay for that kind of environment. It just kind of sometimes it'll drag things down a little bit. So are you saying that Monikers is like a better version of Time's Up? I've actually never played Monikers.
I think it is.
Okay.
I think it, especially based on the kind of things that I would want to recommend to people, it's a more accessible version of that game. It's a game that doesn't get dated so quickly because it's not about who was in the movies in the last 3 years. It's not offensive in the way a lot of current party games are. It's not trying to be
None of the cards are just outrageous.
And there are some smart decisions made in the development of that game.
I
think that's fair.
And here I admit I thought it was like sort of a ripoff, but that's good to know that they've actually, kind of thought about it and made something that's a little bit better. I'll have to try it out sometime. So how do you start designing a large group game? And I think from there we'll stem into kind of some of the things you have to be aware of and some of the challenges and things like that. So Drew, what do you think? If you have an idea, how do you get started with one?
You're on a road trip and you come across somebody who asks for like a little bit of money and you're really rude to them, but little did you know that they were a large group game designer, and then they curse you with the idea for a large group game, and now you have to design it.
That is surprisingly accurate. Yeah, it is a lot like having a witch's curse put on you.
Yeah.
This is why this podcast is actually a social game. So let's go over to Graham. Graham, how do you get started on a large group game?
Sure. So I think the most important thing, if you're going to get into one of these games, is you need to decide what core social interaction you really want in the game and then build everything around it. A lot of the games I've made are from being around, like watching a thing or being around an environment and finding this social interaction that I hadn't really experienced in a game and wanted to explore, like Party Politics. That was a lot based on working on my dad's local government campaign. He was running for office, and it's an area where he was not in the majority party, so there's this. Of the people working at a precinct, there was this sense of like, okay, well, we're working together, except for if we make it clear that we're in this party, then we're not going to get any extra votes and we're all going to lose. So there was this weird dance between like, well, I agree with you, but I'm looking out for myself. And I liked that interaction and thought about the ways in which that could work in a game and kind of spiraled from there.
So basically like, players are on, or a subset of the players in the game, they're on the same team, but only one of them is going to win.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the kind of interaction that you wanted to model and try to make interesting. Okay. Yeah.
And my first game, The Fittest, was about, I wanted a game where you didn't, like, you betrayed everyone, you don't trust anyone, and that's how it's supposed to go. That there are times when you need to work together, but it's the most socially acceptable that you would go back on your word, and the most fitting thing I could think of for that is reality shows where everyone's like, well, no, this is a game. I'm not here to make friends. That you get into that and like, okay, I'm going to build around that. I'm going to build around you're not supposed to trust people. You're not going to hate people for betraying you at the end of this game.
Mm.
So that, I think, is a good place. If you're just wanting to get into the space and you don't have anything in particular you want to see, this is where I make a recommendation that I think I've made to everyone I've met over the past couple months, and it's you should watch The Genius.
You should watch The Genius. That's true.
It's this Korean reality show, and it's really good. But specifically, if you're going to do a large group game, it's kind of like window shopping for every possible social interaction between people. You know, if you watch these things like, oh, I really like the dynamic that happened there, then that's a really easy way to explore what it is you want to do, what kinds of interactions you want to have in your game. First season's on YouTube. You can find it.
Yeah, we will actually have a link in the show notes for the first season of The Genius. Do we know, is any other season available?
They're available. There are 4 seasons of that show. The first season is on YouTube. If you watch the first season and like it, like I do, you'll be able to find the rest of them.
Okay, that sounds vaguely piratey.
There's no rights to distribute that show outside of South Korea, so you know, it is what it is.
I gotcha. Okay.
I don't think that show properly licenses all the songs it uses, so
certainly accurate.
There's an episode where it just starts playing the theme to the Avengers, which I'm pretty sure it didn't pay for.
Yeah.
All right. I know that has the Genius has slowly wormed its way through the consciousness of the designer community. The link will be in the show notes for the first season on YouTube. And like Graham said, if you really, really like it, then you can do some searching and come up with it, or just tweet at Graham and he'll tell you how to find it.
That's true. I'll do that.
All right. So you're saying start with the kind of the interactions that you want to model. Anything to add on to that, Drew, other than a witch's curse?
yeah, there is. First thing I want to just follow up. You said something about in the design of the fittest, you wanted people to be able to betray each other and have that be the expected, like the default mode of behavior. Is that something you think is lacking from other games in that genre, like where people get betrayed and then they feel that it shouldn't have happened? Something like that?
Well, certainly at the time, you know, it's gotten better over the like last few years. They really explored the space. But at the time, especially, the default reaction was the sort of the diplomacy reaction of, we agreed on this thing and then you backstabbed me. I hate you. I'm not only not playing this game with you ever again, but also I'm moving out of the country. I'm never going to see you again. Goodbye. And I've played one game of diplomacy in my life, and I still mm-hmm. know 2 of those people. So, yeah, I'm pretty happy about that.
That's a win.
But yeah, the thing about that is, you know, with a game like that, you feel like, no, I was supposed to do this, but you messed it up. Like, whereas if you set up a game where it's like, no, and under no circumstances were you supposed to trust me, I had no motivation to continue. If you just set up the context right, then that was my idea, was I wanted a game where you set it up where it's okay. Like, yeah, no kidding. That's what you're supposed to do. You were supposed to mess with me. That was good. Good job. And, you know, there are still people who are, you know, sore losers and you have to deal with that. But if you set up the game right, you can keep that to a minimum.
Okay. So I wanted to ask about that because addressing a thing that happens often that's kind of negative socially in these games is sort of why I started working on Jinx as well. So Jinx is a big cooperative sort of trivia-ish game. The main mechanism in the game is you're going to flip over a category card, and taking turns around the table, each pair of people is going to basically count down from 3 and say something that fits in that category, with the goal being to never say the same thing as your partner and not say something that's already been said before. And you have kind of a weakest link scoring mechanism, basically how many pairs you can do before you bust, essentially. So it's kind of a push of luck thing. One of the things that I wanted to try to address with that was, in a lot of these types of, one of the things we talked about with Time's Up before is you aren't sure of something that's in a category or what's on a specific card, and you get left out and you end up kind of losing because of that. So that was something I wanted to try to get to, was making it so that an individual player isn't going to be like out of contention. So I thought a cooperative game might be a decent way of kind of addressing that. And the other thing was having it be a cooperative game kind of addresses a common disconnect I see in some of these kind of social, mostly the party type of games, but you'll also see it in some of the social deduction games, where playing it the way that's the most fun and interesting is not necessarily playing it the way that would get you to the game's win condition.
Yeah.
And basically making a cooperative game makes it so that actually, yes, they're the same, which I think is a good thing.
Right. And a cooperative party game is an area that doesn't have that many options, right? So there's a lot of area to explore there.
I mean, people basically play games that way was my thought. Like, people play apples to apples or whatever. Like, they don't play it competitively usually. Like, they keep score and keep the cards or whatever, but you're kind of just going around the table and doing stuff. So why not actually make that the design of the game and not just the effect that no one actually cares about that victory condition?
Right. Build the roads where people walk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suspect something like apples to apples, they may have felt like they needed to have that because that's what is expected, you know, and in order for like a mass market retailer to pick it up. So I wonder how much of that was the designers and how much of that was more like expectations pressure to put something like that in.
There are definitely players that are also that, though. So that's the main thing is.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
I'll be honest, I'm one of them sometimes where it's like, okay, to understand this game, I need to understand what my end goal is. You know, whether it's that important, whether I get to it or not, it's a good compass of like, okay, so I'm trying to give good cards. Okay, great. And then you at least have that and you can go from there. How much you care about the end is a different thing.
Yep.
Okay. I know something that helped me a lot when I was working on the most recent iteration of Split the Loot, which is actually really, really different than how it first started, was setting up a table for kind of mapping what I thought the player motivations would be for each type of card that is in the game. And so this helped me to kind of get started with the latest iteration, which I can almost look at it as being a different game and starting like a new game. So I think if you're doing a game that has like a social negotiation, I think doing that kind of I don't know if there's actually a name for that that type of chart or anything, but it's kind of listing out what the roles people will have and the different types of categories or items that are in your game and why someone might want to have those things can really kind of illuminate where you're missing social interactions within the game, or at least like an underlying reason why that interaction might occur. And it can also illuminate the interactions that are occurring and help you understand why they are occurring. So for example, if you were playtesting and people keep doing, you know, they are always doing something about this one maybe category of item that's in your game and you're not quite sure why, having like sort of like that chart can start to illuminate, oh, well, it's because it's actually really valuable to like both these situations or both these roles or player types or whatever that might be in the game. So I don't know if either of you guys have kind of done like something like that, so you can try to map out what the social interactions are going to be in your game, or if that was a way that you were able to start. I know for Drew, you started Jinx. It was more like a kind of like a lightning strike when you were playing another game, and so be, yeah. You know. And I know Graham, when you were doing Party Politics, it was because of something you saw in the real world. But I don't know if either of you have tried to experiment with something like that, or just to make sure you're kind of capturing all the possible social interactions that you either want to have happen or are happening in the game.
Well, I'm having that process right now with my new game, The Savant. That's very much a thing where I want the game to be very simple, but I want specific interactions out of it. And so right now I am really trying to build out the possibility matrix. So it really does push people toward wanting to peel off and collude in a corner, wanting to, really have debates with each other rather than just always quickly putting down the, you know, putting down a card or whatever. But yeah, I think because I start with the interaction I want, that is less of a focus for me. And also because I do try to keep games very, very simple, even more than I'm really recommending for other people. I like games with very little in it that do a lot. But yeah, Drew, have you had any issues with stuff?
Not so much. Although I do think there's a parallel in that a lot of the things that I've been trying to do with Jinx have been kind of focused on playing similar party games and identifying things that are kind of pain points, I guess. So stuff like the case where one person just isn't as knowledgeable about the domain, or cases where players feel like they have a throwaway round or a hand of throwaway cards or something where they don't have anything to contribute. Basically trying to figure out how to make it so that those situations don't occur in the game I'm working on, but nothing from the standpoint of those different player interactions. But Jinx is a really different type of game, so there's not as much, there aren't different, really different player roles.
No, go ahead. Yeah, I guess the closest thing that I've dealt with is actually in my first game, The Fittest. I wanted there to be negotiation, but I wanted it broken up by some sort of individual, pure self-interest sort of situations. And so in that game, you have challenges that are these big group things. And then occasionally, a couple times a game, you'll have a trial, which is an individual competition. And those were a real pain to get working right, because they would come up too much, and then you didn't really have the interaction that you wanted to for those, or they'd be too powerful, and someone could just sit over to the side, wait, you know, only do the individual stuff, and then they're not interacting with anybody else at the table. So when you have like a balance issue like that, then you really... It can be tough to find a balance, but yeah, it's you just got to keep playtesting for months and years and generations.
Yeah, I guess if you have a game where there are somewhat asymmetrical roles or possibly asymmetrical goals, which you'll have a lot of time. So the Resistance is the classic example because it's extremely popular and very well done. So you know, you have two teams. And it's either, what, two or three members of the Resistance? And
right.
Yeah, depending on the
depending
player
on
count.
The player count.
Right. so yeah, you have two teams that have different goals in that game. And so you have a lot of asymmetric, like we some of us need this win condition, some of us need this win condition. And we, because of the way that those interact, and that's where you have a lot of real interesting, you know, social interactions that happen in that game. And I have no idea how, you know, what the design process was for that game. I haven't seen any designer diaries or anything like that. But I imagine that it was probably very helpful to have some type of, you know, matrix that would say, okay, you know, if you are this role and you're in this type of situation, these are like the what I would think the motivations would be for the players, right? Or if you have something like, what's the Deception Murder in Hong Kong? Have either of you guys played that yet?
I have.
Yeah, that game is excellent. I love that game.
Yeah, I have not had a chance to play it, but I've heard nothing but good things about it. But that one has, it's what, like sort of like one traitor, right, Drew?
Yeah, so do you want me to just...
Yeah, go ahead. Give a quick explanation.
So Deception Murder in Hong Kong is kind of a combination of Mysterium and a storytelling game with a traitor. So the way that you're going to play it, all of the players except for one are detectives who have rows of cards in front of them that represent murder weapons and evidence. One of those detectives is secretly also the murderer. And the final player, who's sort of the ghost role from Mysterium or the game master, everyone's going to close their eyes. And the player that's the murderer is going to select two of the cards in front of them to be the murder weapon and the key evidence. So, I don't know, fire and crumbs, okay? So those are the things that happen. The murder weapon is a fire, and there's some key evidence that's some crumbs. Essentially, the game master then is going to have to use these limited clue cards that have a really simple question and a few options on them to try to build a story about why that's the case. So they're kind of going to have to come up with a crime in their head of where someone was killed with fire and crumbs were important to knowing how they died. And then they're going to take these cards that have questions on them, like what time of day was it? What clothing was the victim wearing? These types of things, and pick one of the five really vague options on there to try to nudge the team towards picking the right pair of cards. And the especially cool thing about it is that those cards have to be both in front of the same person. So everyone that's not the murderer knows all the cards in front of them are wrong and will correctly argue against anyone trying to pick them. So there's a pretty good motivation for everybody to argue, which is what the game's built on.
Yeah, so that one, it seems like, because you've got, you know, those the asymmetric roles in that game, that it is really important to make sure that in those social interactions that you would have cover, right?
Yeah.
To make sure that it's not 100% obvious that, oh, well, you're arguing this thing, so clearly, you know, you're the spy, right? Or, you know, whatever the term is, right? And
so that's the cover, right?
Right.
Is each player has the set of cards in front of them that it's reasonable for them to... It is always reasonable for a player to argue strongly against the cards in front of them being correct.
Right, right.
Regardless of who they are.
Yeah, so I think if that's the kind of interactions you're looking for, is the... Like the highly social, I guess I would call that negotiation. I don't know if there's a better term for that or not. Negotiate, arguing. You know, that to me, that debate. Seems. Say that again.
Debate, possibly.
Debate. Yeah. I can see that as well. Yeah. So, some kind of combination of debating, negotiation, and just straight out yelling, maybe, depending on your on your group. But I think like that is like listing out, like making a chart. I think is really helpful to just get a handle around the social interactions that you're either trying to drive or you're finding that are arising through playtesting and that you actually like. And so then you want to make sure that you're reinforcing those things. Otherwise, I think, at least for me, and this may not be true for everyone, I think that trying to hold these types of things just like in your head doesn't work. When you go to make changes without being able to try to trace back to a specific, almost like a requirement. It's almost like a requirements document, I guess, in a way. You're saying, okay, if I'm making this change, how is this tracing back to one of the motivations that has to exist in this game or should exist in this game? Versus if you're doing something like a Euro game, you know, if you are making a change there, it's probably a little bit easier to know, oh, well, it's because mechanically this thing is just simply isn't working, or the math is way off over in this section. So clearly, yeah, if we manipulate the points over here, that's going to work out a little bit better. So I think when you're trying to make sure that you're really having those social dynamics going on in your game, again, at least for me, just making a chart of what they are intended to be and what's reinforcing them or what is, or what kind of barriers you might want to throw up within your game to potentially have like either a carrot or a stick, I think is really, really helpful. And I would definitely recommend anyone who's going to have those kind of interactions in a large group game, try to kind of track them in that manner. And whenever you're making changes, refer back to those and say, okay, you know, this change I think is going to drive this particular motivation or this particular interaction. And hopefully it does. But if it doesn't, then you might have to go back and say, okay, you know, why wasn't it driving it the way that I thought it would?
And I think that's important for a lot of games, but in these games in particular, it's not just a matter of, okay, players aren't putting their workers on the market as much as I want. Like, it's more abstract concepts. It's not necessarily something you have on the board. If you want a sort of interaction, then you need to write down that as a goal rather than just say, like, well, here are the places that you can put a tile, right? Like, you need concepts in there as well.
Right. Yeah. I think the key there, what you said, Graham, is this is a lot more abstract sometimes when you know you're actually getting it play tested and trying to determine why something is or isn't working is, I think, a lot harder in this style of game than it is in other styles of games. And that might just be because that is a weakness for me as a designer. Who knows? Maybe other designers like, oh, this is easy. Of course it's, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they try to design some other style of game, and for them, that's, you know, much more difficult. For trying to, like, playtest a social game other than having enough players, and actually running through a playtest, I think this is the kind of game for me that's a lot more difficult to analyze and process and try to, you know, come up with what I think are the right solutions based on the results of a playtest. And it's a lot more touchy feely than other types of games that I've worked on. It's a lot more, at least for me, a lot more like gut feeling. You know, like, I think this will work, like that kind of thing. And, you know,
I think it's a byproduct of the fact that the final games in these sort of large group sessions, they're more forgiving of chance imbalance, which can be a good thing if you want to build a game where sometimes you're in a good position and sometimes you're not, right? Like, then you're just, you're almost talking about sort of poker in that situation where it's about playing your hand. So it's the opposite of like a two-player abstract. It's the opposite of chess, where it's like, no, this can't be imbalanced. If you play chess, but they have one, like two fewer pawns, then that's not fair. That no one will enjoy that game.
Except for unless it's really bad chess.
Sure. Though that has its own like third dimension of whatever.
Yeah.
But I think because you can make a game that's a little more forgiving of some balance issues in small scale, that when you're playtesting, it's tough to see those because it's more forgiving of them. So it's hard to pinpoint like, oh, here is the specific point. You can't just like chart out, here's everyone's points and here's all their actions. Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it can be fun to play a large group social game and have like, well, you know, I didn't have the best setup, you know, it didn't totally get what I want, but I stayed in there and I really competed, and that can be a lot of fun. So eliminating all of that maybe isn't what you always want to do, but during the playtesting process, it is a nightmare.
Yeah, I think every design, you know, you need to put it in front of a lot of different people. You know, you can't only have the same people playing it. But I think that's even more true for any Definitely. Type of large group game that has a very large social aspect to it. So, like for example, with Split the Loop, I took it to a local game convention here in North Carolina called Whose Turn. Several of us had some playtests there for various designs on Friday afternoon. And most of the people who stopped by to playtest were people that either we didn't know at all or didn't know very well. And they're not like our regular playtesters. And so first of all, a big thanks to everyone who did come out, in case you happen to be listening, which is probably not likely, but we're still thanking you.
That's happened before. Yeah. Who knows?
That is true. It has happened before. And but beyond just, thanks for coming out and playing, thanks for giving us a really different perspective. For Split the Loot, I had a group that it was the most non-contentious game I've ever seen. Like every single time, in the game, there's 8 rounds and you're gonna, after the negotiation phase, everyone's gonna vote, simultaneously on whether they like how the loot is split or not. And in that playtest, all 8 rounds passed and 6 out of the 8 were unanimous. It was crazy. And this is a 5-player game.
Yeah.
And that I until that playtest, I was feeling like pretty good about the design. But that showed me that it wasn't nearly as close to good as I thought it was. And I revamped the deck quite a bit, and I revamped a couple of the outcomes of voting based on that playtest. And it's definitely a better game now just because of playing it with a different group that, you know, really, really played it very differently than, like we have at our meetings. So yeah, I think it's even more crucial to get outside whatever your normal playtest group is if you were designing this kind of game, and just putting it in front of other people and seeing what happens.
With games that have less of a social element, if you have people in a playtest play basically against their self-interest. You talk about that cooperative game, and I've played Split the Loot a number of times and know there are times when you should not be doing that, but it may take some time to learn. That they'd say, well, no, they'll just learn next time, and you know, that's not a problem. They just haven't figured it out. But especially in a social game like this, you need people to be able to be really bad at the game and have nothing break.
Yeah.
That you need people to not necessarily play the logical play, not necessarily, you know, play to win. That you need the game to be totally ready for that.
Right. Because, you know, when you're talking about social interactions, sometimes logic goes out the window, or someone has an internal logic that doesn't jibe with your sense of internal logic. And yeah. So what's logical for them is not logical for you. And it's really, yeah, really important to make sure that your game is resilient to those types of players that would do something that is totally fine, or at least it better be fine, because that's what they're trying to do. But it's not at all like, you know, what you would expect based on kind of how you set up the, you know, the model for your game. And you're giving me a strange look, Drew.
Oh no,
I'm just the whole episode.
Well, that's true.
It reminds me of Bang, and specifically the anecdote that Daniel shared when Zahn a couple episodes back, a few episodes back, of the correct thing to do being to shoot them, but you don't really know if they're, you know, the guy or not, but it's actually just correct in the framework of the game to shoot them. But there's a lot of people that are going to have a lot of social pressure against, like, attacking. Well, I don't know if they're the bad guy or not, so I should just not do it. And the results is that they're just not going to play the game.
Yeah. Bang is such a game. I have seen that played badly so many ways that I really have to give it the due respect that it doesn't totally break when that happens. I've seen people play it and it's like, I'm never going to look at my role. That way you never know who I am. It's like, well, are you playing the game really? But the game, like, while I don't like them when they do that and the game doesn't play quite as well, like, it doesn't totally break. You can still play the game with people being really weird and just going off and doing their own thing. But yeah, so, sure. But especially that thing where it's like, no, you should shoot someone every turn. That is the logical thing to do. Well, it is and it isn't, because then there's the social pressures of people are going to shoot you because you're too logical about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually why I like Bang the Dice game, because it's 15 minutes.
I see.
Yeah.
It also makes you. Like, you don't have the choice to not. It's like, those are the dice you rolled. You're doing it.
That's true. Shooting. Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, you can choose to re-roll some of them, depending on what you roll. Can, but yeah, it's like, oh.
You end up, you know, with a gun. You got to shoot somebody.
Right. I rolled all these arrows. Whoops. Oh, well. It's going to be you because you're within range, you know. So, yeah, it is a little bit of a out of your control to some extent.
It kind of does the thing that Graham was talking about earlier, where, you know, you have this decision that looks like a social decision. There's some, like, you don't want to lose face by being the first person that shoots at somebody and now you're bad. But that game makes you do it, right? It makes you do that in maybe a similar way to how the fittest incentivizes you to backstab people or to not completely cooperate.
Yeah.
Like, there's actually a mechanical thing there that's like, obviously don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
That if Bang forced you to shoot, then that would be a very different game. And there are some reasons why it doesn't. But
yeah,
you're right. That people wouldn't be so mad because, like, well, I had to shoot someone, and I'm not shooting the sheriff because I don't have a death wish. So it had to be one of you three. It was a pretty good chance that it was you. So don't be mad at me.
It gives you that cover, right?
It does.
Like, it wasn't just, I made this selection and people are going to have feelings about my selection.
I think the notion of cover is really fascinating in not only in Bang, but a lot of these games, right? Where,
oh, sure.
Especially where you have like some type of hidden identity, like the notion that I'm doing this and I have a logical reason for it, or at least you think it's logical. Someone else may disagree. Like that seems like that might be one of the sort of the key pillars that you need to have in this style of game.
Definitely.
And I think to touch back on like the chart or the matrix, I think that's where you can make sure that you're covering all the different types of reasons or cover that players would have for making different decisions or like choosing different actions in your game. And I think that's where that really helps to make sure that players are having that kind of cover, that they can at least make some type of defense of whatever the decision is that they made. And then it would be up to the other players in the game whether they buy that, whether they like, I can see how you think that, but no, you're just wrong. Therefore, you're the spy, and stuff like that.
You actually have a really good system for that in Split the Loot right now, and I just wanted to call that out. The fingerprint system. There is a hidden role that is the cop that is trying to get the fingerprints of everyone, right? But everyone else also has a motivation for taking those. So it's not clear. One, you don't have to totally bluff to be like, oh, I'm the cop, so I'm taking all the fingerprints, and then take all the things with fingerprints on them. That you actually get something out of that. But also, like, it's not totally suspicious that you'd want some, but still you can keep an eye on that. You have cover, but you are exposing yourself a little. And I like that system.
Well, thank you. Publishers, contact me. No. But that is exactly why I had to chart it out. And it's like, okay, for a card, if it has your color fingerprint on it, okay, obviously, you want it. Why would the other roles want that thing? All right. Okay. The undercover cop needs it because they need to get at least one color to accuse someone at the end of the game. Other players might want it because it's a set of an item and that's going to be more valuable for them. I think I've got one card in there right now that is breaking the motivation for all the players, and I gotta think about that one a little bit more. But yeah, that's kind of how I arrived at that system is just by charting it out and making sure you can sort of put it like an X in each box that yes, there is motivation of why each player would want that card.
So that's going to segue into something I wanted to get to. I know we've already been talking a little bit, but when you were playtesting that game this last weekend, there was an issue where the player who was the cop was specifically paying attention to their neighbor's cards just because the size of the table, right? And I think that's something that we haven't talked about really at all with regards to larger group games, is that there's often like logistical or accessibility concerns with how much information you have to look at, how easy it is to look at that information, and if you need to look at that information without it being obvious, it's even worse. So Graham, with party politics,
absolutely, you need to be able to see it. I mean, this is more of a design thing, but even in the prototype stage, you need to be able to see what is happening seven people away from you. You need to be able to at one glance see what's happening all the way down there, and that's really important. That's at a premium. But you can also, with a large group, play with the idea of proximity, that the idea of, okay, that person is far away from you, you can build that in, that like, yeah, it's not hidden information, but it's obscured information. It's information that's out of sight, out of mind, that there's some stuff you're paying more attention to over here that makes for some interesting interactions.
Most extreme version of that would be something like Seven Wonders, where you don't ever care about, well, you care a little bit, but you can't really impact it. So it's harder for you to care about the information of what the players across the table from you are doing.
Right.
Where these two guys, I choose directly what cards they get, and I also benefit from stuff that they've got, so I pay more attention to it.
Yeah.
But I think that also lends itself to a lot of the simplicity you were talking about earlier, where the information you have to look at is something that you can, stare at from across the table and actually have a chance of getting.
Right.
As opposed to if it's like, here's my paragraph on this card in 8 points.
Yeah. And that's what I'm trying to do with my new game, The Savant, is, okay, I'm trying to make it an interesting game, but also, like, what do they have over there? Oh, it's a blue 4. Okay, great. That's all I need to know. That's the information I have. It's easy to see from all the way over here, that you can make sure the variables are as simple as possible, even if it is just like, who is that person? Oh, that person, that person was the deputy. Oh, okay, great. Now I have all the information I need to know about that, rather than that person is this one special role that, now here, read this card. Hey, pass this card down three cards to that person so they can read it and then pass it back. And then when they're finished reading it in 45 seconds, then we'll continue playing the game unless they need to look at another card. That's the part where you really need to make sure that you can get the information quickly.
Yeah, I think that's a really good call out of like this style of game is not going to lend itself to a lot of like, okay, everyone has to take 30 seconds to read this card, you know, and you have to pass it around the table and it just grinds to a halt, you know.
Some of the custom werewolf roles fall into that.
I've heard rumor of such roles, but that is definitely something to watch out for. And I think this touches a little bit back to our decision scales episode, but if you're trying to do something that's global, that's going to touch everyone, it's got to be something that's really easy and simple to understand. It doesn't mean that it's like, it makes for an easy decision, and it doesn't mean that it makes for an obvious decision, but it just has to be like pretty easy to understand. And like, I think Graham, your example for the Savant is very clear. Yeah. It's a blue four, and that's all the information that you need to be able to tell from 6 feet down, you know, at the table. You know, if someone has, oh, I don't know, you know, in the resistance, right. You know, we remember they voted no on the previous round when this other person was nominated for the mission. Right? So that's global information, you know, that we all have. That's a very simple piece of information, but it doesn't lead to a very simple decision all the time. Having like adjacent decision scale of, you know, I'm only going to be affecting specific players at the table. When you're having that kind of scale, I think you can start to have the information complexity creep up a little bit, but there it's more like, have you guys played Dead Last?
Yep. I haven't.
Yeah. Okay. So Dead Last, is another large group, social game, which I like that one quite a bit, but that one, when you get down to if you have two people at the end, there's like almost a little mini game to resolve the round, and it's still very simple, but that's a very direct interaction, and it becomes just slightly more complex than the rest of the round is, where you're just revealing a color and shooting that color. But because it gets pared down to just two players, at that point you can increase the information complexity just a little bit, and it doesn't drag down the game too much. But it still makes it for something really interesting. But that, at that point, it's because you're just down to an adjacent effect. You're not down to, you're not still having a global impact based on those kind of decisions.
It doesn't mean you can't have something complex in your game. You just have to pick your spot and really design around it. I think the best example for this game doesn't get to be in too large a group, but Cosmic Encounter has a bunch of really complex things that only show up sometimes. But each person gets one, it's at the beginning of the game, and then past that, the actual actions that happen are very simple, are very straightforward. So if you want to have that, okay, here's this big card with a bunch of words on it, if that's really what you want to build your thing around, just make sure you don't have five or six layers of all those cards. Have one, you know, really focus on it, and that way you don't add to it, there's not a bunch of extra stuff in the middle of the game, and you can make that work. You just have to really lean into the one thing you want.
Cosmic Encounter and Dead Last are a really interesting pair of games to have come up right here, because what we were talking about for a big chunk of this podcast was sort of incentivizing players to do the behaviors that you think the game should be built around, and those games accomplish it in really different ways.
Yeah.
So Cosmic Encounter says, you're fighting yellow, figure out why you would want to do that, or if you want to not do that, but that's what's happening. And no one can feel bad at you for doing it. So since that's happening, play some cards. Dead Last just says like nothing to you, right? It's like you kill someone and you're like, oh, all right, I guess we'll figure out who that is, with no, like, you don't have any incentive at the start of the game. And the incentives afterward are built entirely on what decisions were made the first time there. I think if we're talking about social pressures, that's an interesting one. because I've played Dead Last a few times. When I've played it in groups of people where we all know each other, it's been real good. And if you play it in other groups, it's awkward and upsetting potentially, because like if you're familiar with everybody, it's not so bad that like, oh, we just decided let's all shoot Matt right now. But like if you don't know all the people there and you don't know how well they know each other, it's kind of an awkward thing to put on your players, I think. Can cause like a real unpleasant feeling, I think.
That is true. And that touches on a point that I wanted to bring up, is how resilient do you think like a large group game should be for the familiarity of the players with one another? You know, like if you have a game, well, okay, like Seven Wonders, which is not exactly the kind of game that we're talking about, but it does go up to 7 players or 8 with one of the expansions. So that one, you don't need to really know the other players at the table at all, and it'll play just about the same as it would as if you really knew, you know, everyone at the table. Obviously, yeah. You know, if you're playing with people you know well, you'll have more table talk and probably more fun. But it'll, you know, mechanically it'll play, you know, just as well. Something yeah. like Dead Last, and I think you're 100% right, Drew. If you play that with people that you know very well, it's a very, very different experience than if you were playing it with either people you don't know at all, or like a mixed group where maybe you know some people and other people you don't know very well. And the types of interactions and dynamics that come out of that game could be not palatable based on, just the group. So I don't know. What do you guys think? Like should a group or a game of this nature be more resilient based on the familiarity of the players with one another? Or is it fine to have something like Dead Last where it can be not nearly as good of an experience with a group that is not familiar with one another versus one that is?
So I think that's a design choice, right? I don't think it's a hard and fast rule, but I do think that's something you should keep in mind in a real way as you build it. Do you want this to be a game that's a good icebreaker? Do you want this to be that sort of game? And I generally try to, but it's also important to think like familiarity can break a game in a couple of different ways. Like we were talking about Time's Up and Monikers earlier, those games, familiarity with the players on your team is really important, because whether you're selecting the cards or giving clues, you knowing what they know is a big deal.
Right.
But that's just kind of inherent to that game. You can't change that part of the game. You can mitigate it, which I think they've done pretty well in Monikers, but there's still like that's the game you're doing. But you can build a game to be a fun, you know, hey, we're just all going to, you know, it's a party. We don't really know each other. Let's play this. And you can build a game around that. But you can build a large group game around familiarity. I think there's room in the market for that. But it is a choice you're making.
Mm. So you would not say one or the other is quote unquote better?
I mean, it's all about the design you're making, right? I think if you are trying to get, say, more than 8 players, then you should at least be prepared for a lack of familiarity, that you shouldn't build that totally around that. I think the sweet spot for that sort of game really is around 6. But yeah, I think it's better or worse depending on what kind of game you're trying to make, what kind of interaction you're trying to have.
Yeah. I think that, yeah, it's a design choice, but you have to kind of acknowledge that as you increase the player count, like Graham said, as you increase the player count, you're going to increase the likelihood that someone in the group is new, just because of how difficult it is to get a group of that size. And so if you're making your decision based entirely on how many groups are going to be able to play this game, then there's a pretty obvious choice on that end that a game that's going to play that kind of large group does need to be more accessible, just because otherwise it can't be played well. But fine with like being Mega Civilization or whatever, right? Like, yeah. But, like that doesn't get broken out. Like, hey, you know, it's 10:30. Let's play Mega Civilization right now with these people that are at this con. Just everyone that's here. Come on, let's all go and do it.
10:30 a.m. Maybe.
Yeah, that's planned ahead of time,
right?
Because that's the kind of game it is. And if you're designing that, you just kind of that's the consequence of designing that game. So
yeah, and you can build a game for where familiarity enhances the game, where it adds an extra dimension, but it's not a qualitative difference. Mm. We briefly mentioned Two Rooms and a Boom at the very beginning of this, and I think that's one of those games where you are almost never going to play with everyone that you know, but you're probably going to know a couple of people, and you like your fragment of the game will be very different because you'll probably end up talking to the people you know, and whether you're on the same team or not, it can bring up some really interesting situations, but also that game doesn't need you to know everybody, and in a way is built for knowing some people. I think that's the most ideal thing for that game.
Yeah, Two Rooms and a Boom is a really interesting one because I think that you almost will have a spectrum of experiences with that game based on how long you play it with the current group and also how well you know the group when you start. And you can still have a good experience if you know no one. I'm not sure if the publisher still does it at Origins or not, but for a while they were running large group games, like 50 plus players at Origins for like 3 hours, and they would just keep playing and people loved it. And I think they would trickle in new roles every couple of games to keep it from just having the same roles all the time, which also really helps for that game, so people understand how to play, and then you start layering in some of the more complex roles that are maybe not 100% obvious what to do with them if you are just learning the game. So that one, it seems like, yeah, it actually is rather resilient to not only how familiar you are or are not with the group, but also as you become more familiar, the experience of that game, I would think generally would just become more enhanced. I don't think it would get worse the more that you know the group that you're playing with. But it's still good even if you don't know the group, I would think more times than not anyway.
Yeah, and on the other end of that spectrum is Werewolf, which in my experience, the more you play with the same group, the more people are just like following the decision tree, and it's like, well, you wouldn't say that unless you're doing this. So that people logic it out playing it too much, whereas Two Rooms and a Boom, I think, is a little better with that.
Hmm. Yeah, and then that's where you have all the people at Gen Con that play Werewolf for literally 8 hours in the hallway.
I mean, some people are, you know, what are you gonna do?
Yeah. Hey, it's their fun, so that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Matt, you, what are you talking noise on Werewolf? You haven't even played Werewolf, yeah?
I have not played Werewolf, but I've watched it played. And
how?
How
have you not played
it.
Werewolf?
I've also never played Magic. You guys know this, so
that's a mistake.
There's lots of games that I haven't played.
Yeah. But, I mean, Werewolf, you know, Darewolf.
I would have thought
you're
that
right
like.
There.
Yeah. I would have thought that like you would have played it by accident at some point, like you just walked into a room and you're like, what's going on in here, and then you were killed.
No, that's Dead Last. You walk into a room like, yeah, come play, yeah. And then you get killed. Yeah
we need one more.
That's what we did to Seth Jaffe at Gen Con.
Oh wow.
Yeah, he's we're playing Dead Last at the hotel, and he came over. He's like, yeah, come join us. And it's sort of like a, I don't know if it's an accepted metagame, but like the person who's newest to join the game, everyone shoots that person.
Right.
Because
that's the type of game it is.
Yeah, it is. It is. And then they learn how the game works. And on the next round, they're probably not going to be the initial target, but they might still be, and they better play their ambush card. Otherwise, they're going to be eliminated very quickly again. I don't know. I just Werewolf was not a thing like growing up or anything, or in college or anything like that. In college, it was Presidents, which is known by a different word that I'm not going to say on a family podcast.
Sure.
Yeah, but that was our large group social game because that was drinking and stuff like that.
Okay.
But now, yeah, never. And I also like. It seems to me like the people who do Werewolf are also, and I may be 100% incorrect in this, but it seems like they're also the people that are more likely to do D&D. And that's not my thing at all. Nothing against D&D, but it just doesn't really appeal to me, that kind of thing. But anyway, the other aspect here I wanted to touch on about designing large games or large group games rather is the playtesting of them. We've touched on this a little bit, and I think what I'm realizing from playtesting is I think they should always be recorded now, especially for this type of game. I think that they should be video recorded, and you should go back and rewatch it and really listen and watch like people's reactions. And like, I think, you know, video recording playtests of these types of games is going to be way more valuable than trying to, like ask questions like you normally would after a playtest or get immediate input and things like that. I think that what people think is true is not necessarily true for how they think they're perceiving games like this. And I don't think it's because they're lying. I think it's because it's tough to know. And I think by observation, you might actually have better kind of, I hesitate to call it data, but I think you'd have better feedback by observation and taking really careful notes and trying to notice trends than you would, like, what'd you guys think? You know, like, how'd that make you feel? Sure. You know, that kind of thing.
I think it might be useful, and this is coming from, you know, I haven't worked on this type of game, but it might be useful to, when you're doing this sort of video recordings, or even if you're not doing the video recording, but you have the opportunity to make a note of a specific decision, to go back in and ask people to sort of think aloud why they made that specific decision. Like, what were their motivations, the pressures they felt were on them to make the decision at that time, just based on like what you said, their beliefs at that point in the game might not be right, like factually, but they don't know what all the information is, but that's what's going to influence the decisions that they've made. And I think even in this, a lot more than a game where you can, you know, tabulate scores and get a pretty good idea of what's going on, you need to drill in a little bit deeper to what the player was thinking. Why didn't they contest this vote? Why did they vote yes here? These types of things. I also think this is slightly joking, but slightly not. You should have them take a Disney princess quiz at the beginning.
Okay.
So I'm kind of joking. But like, if you ask your playtesters at the beginning, here's like four hypothetical game situations. What would you do in these situations? Like, just real basic player type stuff. Maybe you could get a little bit more out of that. Like, basically getting them to think about what pressures they think are on them in these given situations. Basically, ask them kind of like prisoner's dilemma kind of things at the start. Like, this person betrayed you last round. They now have offered you a offer that's good, but last round they did this bad thing to you. How likely are you to vote yes for this? I think that might actually be really helpful in a game like this, because you could be able to, like, we've speculated a little bit about, like, oh, this group seems like they were less confrontational, but you might actually be able to quantify it and say, oh, no, they all said they wouldn't. Everyone said they would take the good deal from the person that screwed them over last round, so maybe they're just not confrontational.
Right.
That's pretty unprincipled questioning, but I think there's probably something to it.
Unprincipled?
No, I just mean, like, those are arbitrary game situations that you don't. There's no way that you could say that those mean that person is confrontational or not. But if they're actual situations from the game, you might be able to, I don't know. IRB doesn't have to approve it. It's playtesting. You're fine. So,
yeah. Yeah. I think like asking those kinds of questions during the game is difficult, because that might poison, you know, the results. But if you actually record it and can show the player later, like, hey, right here, you did this thing, and here's the context. Can you tell me, you know, what led to that decision? I think that might get you a little bit more robust feedback, which is, it's also a lot more work, of course, to do that kind of thing. But yeah, the more that I've playtested Split the Loot and, you know, other of our social games that people are working on, the more I'm really leaning towards trying to do video recording in some manner to get, you know, especially to catch things that I'm missing, simply because watching all those social dynamics in real time is real difficult. Yeah, again, at least for me, maybe other designers can do it easier. Maybe they are just more in tune with watching those kinds of things. But yeah, for me, I think I need to record it and watch it a little bit more carefully.
Yeah. Well, however you do it, it's important to remember that playtesting a large group game will require a lot more work, a lot more energy. It's just going to take a lot out of you to do it.
Right.
So know what you're getting into.
Yeah, there's no solo testing these games, or at least not in, I would think, a meaningful manner. If you can solo test one of these, wow, good for you. I would love to know how you can do that. I just doesn't seem anything more meaningful than like theory crafting. That, okay, sure, you can do that, but actual having real, you know, meaningful tests, I don't see how you can possibly do it solo. Lots of other types of games, oh sure, you know, you can do those solo and kind of play like a role, and so very clearly here I'm going to put my worker in this spot and take two gold and or whatever, but games of this nature, it just doesn't seem possible to me. And because of that, you know, like what Graham said, yeah, playtesting is going to be way more difficult. It's going to be a lot slower. You'll need to, you know, if you can have regular sessions, like, you know, sort of like we do, yeah, that'll help. But it's just going to be, I think, much slower than other types to get that game to progress it at the, you know, at the same rate that you would other styles of games. Anything else we want to talk about designing large group games?
I think that covers it.
Yeah.
All right. So all of that is not to discourage anyone, of course. I think that large group games are very rewarding, both to play and design. You just have to kind of go into it eyes open and know that it's different. And again, at least for me, it's harder. And I suspect for a lot of people, it's probably more difficult than it would be other styles of games. But if you want to do it, absolutely. Don't take this as any type of like warning, you know, yeah.
Take it as a challenge.
There you go. Yeah. Yep. All right. Let's go into our news segment here. Just have two pieces of news. The first one, by the time this podcast will drop, it's going to be several weeks after the Trickster project has ended. But this is the first one we are recording since it has ended. So we just wanted to congratulate group member Daniel Solis on that success. It raised just under $36,000 from 1,184 backers, which is awesome. I believe if you go to the Kickstarter page, you can pre-order it. I'll try to verify. Usually they will allow you to pre-order any of the games that have successfully funded on Kickstarter. The pledge changes to a pre-order button. So hopefully Action Phase Games will do that at some point with the project. So you can get in on it if you missed it and you are interested. Or otherwise, it will be available at retail at some point. Think it's scheduled for later this year. So congratulations to Daniel. Very exciting.
Such a good game.
Yeah, looks spectacular, and yeah, looking forward to that one hitting the table. In the official published way, I should say.
Sure.
The other piece of news is Unpub 7 is coming. That is March, 17th through the 19th? Is that what it is? Or is it the 16th or the 18th?
Right.
I should have looked this up. Yes, the 17th through the 19th of March. That's Friday through Sunday. If you are a designer and you have a table or a VIP playtester badge, of course, you can come on Friday. If you are just a playtester, you are welcome to come on Saturday or Sunday, or both. That would be great. You don't need a ticket, just a playtest. You can just come on out and help playtest games. All three of us will be there. Drew has a table. Graham, you do not have a table this year, correct?
Not this year, because as it happens, playtesting a large group social game takes a lot out of you. So I didn't get to really talk to a lot of people last year. So this year, I really, really want to talk to people and see what they're doing.
Yeah. But Graham will be around in case anyone would like to meet up with him. And I'm sure you can find some space to playtest something if you would have the opportunity.
Yeah.
And so if you want to play Graham's Savant game or Party Politics, I make sure you have it with you, Graham. And
I will.
Yeah, we can try to make that happen. Yeah. We'll also have Mark McGee, Daniel Solis, Josh Mills, Adam Skelding. Believe that is it this year from the group. A couple people that went last year can't make it up this year, but we'll still have quite a number of us going up this year.
So, a large group, if you will.
Yes. So, yes, please come on out.
That was a great one.
Yeah, Baltimore, Maryland, March 17th to the 19th. Come say hi to us. We're all very approachable, except for Drew. He's actually a big meanie.
Hey, now.
He's crying.
What?
You can't see it.
That was a weird way to say Josh.
Oh, you're right. I meant Josh. Yeah, it's not Drew. Josh, you're right. You guys look exactly the same. Sorry. Yeah. So please come on out and say hi and play test our stuff and give us feedback, and we'd love to meet you.
And if you can't make it up to Big Ump Pub, then stay tuned. We got a local event coming up in a few months.
That is true. All right, Graham, if people want to get in contact with you, how can they do so?
So you can contact me on Twitter at Color Ninja or on Board Game Geek. I am Color Ninja. If you want to contact me any other way, then do one of those first.
If you do smoke signals that have colors, that'll get Graham's attention.
I mean, show up at Atomic. I don't know. Wave really enthusiastically from wherever you are.
Colorfully.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Drew? If someone wants to get in touch with you, how can they do so?
You could try to tweet at me at Even Weirder Move. If you send me Board Game Geek messages, I will ignore them. So don't do that. People keep trying to trade me nickels. Like, just wooden nickels.
Okay.
So that inbox is dead to me.
Okay, cool. Then. Very cryptic, but okay. And if you would like to get in contact with me on Twitter, I am at Matt Wolf with an E on the end of Wolf. It happens to be the same username on BoardGameGeek. Feel free to, give me trade proposals. I will respond to them, unlike Drew here. If it is for wooden nickels, though, it better be a lot of wooden nickels. I'll just say that. All right. And
invite them to your surprise werewolf game.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're
going
to have that happen.
Please do. Yes.
Actually, I'm going to start that right now on Twitter. We are now playing werewolf with Matt, and I'm just going to invite a bunch of people.
Cool.
Yeah. So if you have anything to add about this episode, we welcome all kinds of feedback. If you go to podcast.gdofnc.com, that will redirect you to our guild on Board Game Geek that we use for feedback for episodes. All feedback is encouraged. And we also have a group Twitter account that you can follow, which is at GD of NC, which stands for the Game Designers of North Carolina. And that will do it for this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast. Remember to avoid werewolf, and we will see you next time.